Accession number 12713, Mr. Tony Temple, Reel 7.
Mr. T. Temple, Reel 7. On the journey out to the Middle East, Mr. Temple, were you prepared in any way for this new theatre and what you may meet when you got there?
There was a lot of preparation, all told, going to a complete change of what we were used to, of peacetime soldiering to a war footing. We didn't know what the position was going to be when we arrived there, albeit we did know that there was no enemy as such there. The Germans weren't in that particular theatre of war at the time. But nevertheless, we had to put it on a war footing simply because we were at war and lectures were always held. So far as the band were concerned, again, we were doing medical lectures and doing practicing wounds, bandaging, splints, fractures, the usual thing which would occur. Types of bleeding, how you recognise different types of bleeding, the usual lecture that went on like this the whole time. The rifle companies, of course, they were training the whole time. What training you could get on board was mainly physical training. That was going to be keep you physically fit the whole time that you're on the journey, because it took us about a month to get back. But that was it. More lectures than anything else. But the conditions of the country itself, merely said that you're going to a much drier environment than what you're used to, because China isn't a desert country, as it were. You know, the agricultural country, really, as opposed to going into a very arid country. They emphasised this, of course, that your heat will now be dry instead of humid. Prepare yourself for this. Well, the journey gradually over there, again, the same thing applied. We stopped at Singapore to get off a route march around the town. Bombay was the same. And then we headed straight for the Suez, Port Suez, and we disembarked at Port Suez.
At this point, is it a question to you that of what kind of equipment a stretcher bearer would carry with him in the action situation? Had this been given to you? Were you expected to carry a certain amount of materials or what have you?
Yes, we had the normal equipment of any ordinary rifleman, the ammunition pouches and so forth, and we still had maintained our arms. We didn't lose them at the time anyway. We thought it rather strange that they weren't taken away from us, because under the Geneva Conventions we weren't supposed to carry any arms at all, being a stretcher bearer. But nevertheless, we still carried them. Even going into action, we still carried them. We were then given armbands, which was silly in the form that they took, in the respect that was purely simply a white band with SB on, stretcher bearer. Well, everybody who knows English in the army knows that you are a stretcher bearer would look at that, but some silly German or Italian couldn't read as what SB was, so we were constantly being shot at. And we tried to get these people to realise it wasn't that what we wanted. We wanted a big badge with a red cross on, which would give us at least a form of protection. But it never changed the whole time until I was taken prisoner of war, right the way through the war. Not to my knowledge, it didn't change. And again, when we arrived in Egypt, it was a question of the similar sort of thing. But then we started getting training in desert activities, mainly to start with short route marches, where you were allowed a pint bottle of water to carry with you. And that was as much as that you got. You were sort of gradually brought into the life of going into the desert, as it were. But we were, from Port Suez, we actually went to Azmalia, just off the Bitter Lakes, which is midway between the Port Suez and Port Said.
What date was this?
This was in the January, February era we're talking about. 1940. And you're talking about October, January, February 1940, March. And the regiment actually was split up, or the battalion was split up into about three different parts. A company were left in Port Suez. The main body went to the Moasca barracks in Ismailia. A platoon of one of the companies went to El Kantara, which was halfway between Ismailia and Port Said, which was the railway crossing across the canal, which had to be protected. This was, I suppose, one of the prearranged responsibilities of any job that was given to you at the time. Well, unfortunately, it was ours. He had a company there in Alcantara, and the bulk of the another company on Port Said. Till they eventually changed it, we got more reinforcements, and then the whole battalion was shifted up from Port Suez up into Port Said. But we weren't in barracks at Port Said, we were in warehouses and some cases under canvas. And our duties mainly were to escort ships up and down the canal. And when you go into the canal, we're escorting them so far away on a 3 mile limit, whoever it was. And of course, when Italy came into the war, this changed our role completely, in the sense that an immediate roundup was made of all Italian nationals within our area in Port Said. And this was a job that was supposed to be done by the police, but I don't think the Japanese, Egyptians were so keen on the British troops, at least to my knowledge. They weren't so very friendly. And we had this job. It had to be carried out, of course, and the special camps were set up for these interned Italian civilians. Any military at all, they were put in a different kettle of fish. They went to a prisoner of war camp immediately.
Did you get involved in this?
Not specifically, because, we were at headquarters, which stayed in Port Said, in these warehouses, which we... had occupied. I believe one of them was Cox and Kings, again involved with Cox and Kings. And Thomas Cook's also had these things up there, these warehouses, and we took two or three of those over. And a lot of our time was given over to, whilst we were rounding up these, this was just a short phase of rounding up the Italian civilians and soldier or servicemen, if there was any. And this main time, we still had to escort the ships up and down the canal. And one particular incident I remember, when I think it was a platoon from A Company, or a section from A Company, and when they went out, normally a corporal or a lance corporal was in charge of a section, which were about seven men with a Bren gun. But on these escorts, when they had to go to the 3 mile limit, they used to put an officer on. The junior officer of the company probably used to go on, or that particular platoon. He would pick a number of men from his own platoon and then, you know, do this job. And it was once this bloke was on his actual journey out to the 3 mile limit, because the pilot boat used to, you know, come out with them so they'd take them back again, that he'd heard on radio that the Italians had declared war. Well, he immediately just cut hold of the skip and pinned him into the bridge and said, right, no, we're taking over the ship from here on, we're finished. He sent another two blokes down to the engine room, walloped them, and the remainder of the crew, he just herded them into a saloon and said, right, no, we're now taking charge of the ship. Well, we had no idea how to do anything about the ship. So we had to get the skipper on again. He says, right, you're going back to Port Said. And it was pure luck. I suppose he was damn scared. You know, it must have really frightened them. I mean, our blokes must have been saying, wondering what the bewilderment that suddenly being involved in a war situation that they'd never experienced, they wouldn't be too kind. But this bloke was even worse off. Well, anyway, they got back to, they brought the ship back into Port Said again, and they were interned. So we colored the ship. And I often wondered if those fellas ever got any prize money for bringing that ship back in. But it was never thought of at that particular time, but it was something. But this is the sort of job that we were doing at the time, and I don't know why it was. We were suddenly told that we were going up to the front to Mirza Matru and Sri Barani to relieve the HLI. They spent their usual time up there, and we were the next to go up, but whether it was because of the normal changeover, I don't know, but it was certainly done in a rush. And as we got up there, they came back. We manned the defences at Matru.
What time of the year was this?
Oh, this should be somewhere about the June, July. You're just getting to the hot period when you were in shorts, and well, you wouldn't wear shirts in those days. You just wore you just wore boots, small putties around your shorts, and that was it. You had no shirt on, or no caps.
And had you realised that in this move you were moving nearer to a war situation?
Yes, well, we had known that the Italians had moved down, and they had pushed down through Mirza Matru, through the frontier wire at Saloum. And there was two passes on Saloum. One was the actual Saloum pass, and the other one was Halfar. We used to call it Hellfire, but the correct name was Halfar, which was on the escarpment, through the escarpment, which was a dirt road. I suppose just like a camel track coming in from the desert, as it were, you know, going twisting until it came down to the level part of the escarpment, down to the main roads. And the other one was a proper concrete road. They had came through there. They moved on to Sri Barani, but didn't strike us in Siloam at all. It wasn't true. There was quite a number of regiments there, brigades. Well, probably a full brigade or best part of a division was there at the time.
At Merseymetru, Mr. Temple, under what conditions were you living?
Well, it was a bit like the Phoney War, which was at that point in time taking place on the continent. You know, it was quiet. We were in trenches which had already been previously dug, possibly by the HLI or the engineers, whoever dug them. They were well prepared. For instance, I was with C Company at the time as a stretcher bearer. The RAP, Regimental Aid Post, that we had, I was manning with three of my other colleagues. It was a proper, well-built Anderson shelter, formulated. But this is the only one in it. In actual fact, there was better accommodation than the company commander had, because it was closed at both ends. It was fairly, and it had about six purpose-made bunks in, so that you lay your wounded or your injured on the bunks until they were evacuated behind the lines. But generally speaking, as it was dry, arid country, desert storms and sandstorms and so forth, the hot winds that used to come across, very dry, very dusty, to which we weren't really accustomed. We were really getting our first taste of desert life. It wasn't very pleasant, because another aspect of desert life was the fleas. Where on earth the flies and the fleas came from, I'll never know. There wasn't seen to be anything to eat for them out there, yet there was millions of them. I mean, one of the things that they made up a song that the old lad is singing. Oh, what's it used to go out? Oh, Mother, this Egypt's a wonderful land where there's nought else but flies, fleas, and acres of sand. And this was the situation that you were delved into, and the army issued us this with this flea powder. Well, the fleas loved it. They thrived on it, really did. It certainly didn't affect us very much, but I think this is something that you became accustomed to.
Were they a nuisance to you? Obviously, the numbers.
They were in the initial stages, Harry. But after a while, we just became accustomed to it, you know. And we just allowed delousing ourselves about every day, so and we were sleeping as little as possible. And they were in the blankets. They were all over there. You couldn't get away from them at all. So we just put up with it.
Did they interfere with eating? How were we able
to eat them? The flies did, because every time that you tried to get a fork full of food out of your mess tin or a plate that we had. You happened to chase the flies off as you were putting it into your mouth, sort of thing. The flies were so profuse. And the life was very unpleasant. I would have sooner, as we enjoyed later on, a bit of open life, where you were on the move, but in a static position like Merseymetru. Now, the whole brigade was like this. And the defences were there. Minefields were there. And there was a solitary road up to the point where your defences split on either side of the road, and then you more or less cut through the minefields. But there were, if the Italians had come in and started advancing at all, we would close that road with mines, which the Royal Engineers had left us. They would send a company of blokes up, or whatever they called them, to relay the mines on the road, dig the road up and put them in there in a very short space of time. But that was the only road that was left open where we were. Further over, there was one going out towards a small town on the coast further east, and and the whole of the brigade was more or less like this. So you had your slit trenches and your little bits of dugouts where you slept. More or less it was, I would think, very much similar to the communication trenches which they had in the Great War. This was one of the things I never really realised we were going to still go through this sort of warfare. I thought we'd progressed because we were supposed to be the motorised infantry of the decade, you know, and it appeared to me that we were static here. We were just going to fight another 1914-1918 war. And a lot of the lads seemed to think, well, this is wrong, this, we've got the stuff that to go out and match, which was fairly good enough against the Italians, as we later found out, but certainly wasn't very good against the Germans.
What did you have?
The anti-tank weapon, for instance, was a two-pounder, which, if you go to the Dale Museum, there's one still up there, which was used in the defence of Matru by Adam Wakenshaw, the VC, who carried on firing after all his mates had been killed, and he got the VC for it, firing at the German tanks. Which was a very, very light weapon. I mean, you imagine that you were trying to fight 88 millimetres. Although they could knock you out. You couldn't even see them, you know. They could put you apart without any problem. These 2 pounders, they were good going, but had they been on a larger scale, I think it would have much more easy. We got them at a later stage, later on, like the 6 pounder and the 17 pounder, but they came in later stages. Really, when we should have had them at the beginning. I think a lot has been said about the lack of equipment that we, or good equipment that we had at the time. If we'd had really the best of equipment, which the Germans had, it would have been a short-lived war. How this came about, it's anybody's guess. I don't think that we really, in comparison, that we were much really prepared for what really happened. Against the Italians, yes. And it was shortly after that Wavell decided to have a push-up. I think it was in November.
Before we go on to that, Mr. Temple, were the anti-tank guns spread throughout the companies?
Yes, each company. We had an anti-tank platoon.
So your C company, how would it be?
Well, we would have a couple of them interspersed into the various platoons. The company commander would say what he thought was an advantageous position. As I said, we had this road going through right through the centre of the defence of C company. It was the only concrete road that went up towards the, because it was actually going up towards City Bar anyway. And he would cite that maybe one on either side so that they had a good field of fire. Maybe it had another one further over to cover the front. And then again, at the rear of us, we had 25 pounders manned by the Royal Artillery, of course. They were great guns, and those things. They were all purpose guns, and really they were magnificent. As at a later stage, possibly, we'll tell you a little bit about them. We had to do them in Tobruk, in the siege of Tobruk. But certainly at that particular type, at the time, this was the heaviest that we had, a 2-pounder.
So you'd have an anti-tank platoon. Yeah. What other weaponry would the company have?
Nothing other than Bren guns.
It didn't have any mortars of any kind?
Yes, we all had 3-inch mortars. Again, this was another platoon, a specialist platoon, 3-inch mortars. And then we had each individual section of each company had the 2-inch mortar, which was a very light thing, easily to handle, used in attack. But I don't think they were as effective as what the 3-inch mortar was, or later on the 4-inch, which came aboard. So it left us more or less at, as I say, a position of a phony war, really, when we looked at the stuff that we really had to fight with. Even the aircraft, we had the Gladiators, the biplanes. More fortunately, the Italians had the same. And this was the difficulty with the aircraft. The Savoy, as we knew, the bombers, we could hear them a mile away coming over, the peculiar throb of their engine that we used to see before even the sirens started whirling in the company. We could hear them a mile away coming here, right, get your heads down, get in your trenches ready for them coming. But they would never come down. They were bombed from way up top. We couldn't reach them. And we had then detachments of the Egyptian army on anti-aircraft. Well, as soon as they started dropping bombs, those blokes just went to the dugouts. They didn't want to know. So eventually they were just sent back, and we asked the artillery to provide all blokes with the same equipment. And we got some defensive men by the Royal Artillery then, not the Egyptians. They were useless, absolutely useless.
So you did experience air raids?
Oh, yeah, quite frequently.
What form did they take?
As I say, high-level bombing by the Savoyers, continuously, 3 or 4 times, sometimes half a dozen times, it depended on how the Italians felt. Normally, if it had been the Germans and their blitzkrieg, of course, they would have been walloped, as we were in Tobruk. It was incessant. But with the Italians, it was just, when they thought it was necessary, they would just send a couple of flights of bombers over, escorted by their fighters, which were very much like old Gladiators. And as I say, they were almost identical to the Gladiators. I can't remember, the Ciprianos or something they called them. They would come down stuffing. As I say, we had no aircraft, or very little at the time, and we couldn't tell the difference between those at a distance. At the time, we were talking about instant recognition of aircraft, which they then started to say, well, look, we're going to have to get hold of this, and you've got to be able to recognise aircraft when you see them. And so they started this blitz on recognition of aircraft, which wasn't a bad thing. But they hadn't thought much about it before we got there, until we got these 2 planes, which were almost identical. And we talked to the RAF about this and said, right, I'll tell you what we'll do then. We'll paint our wings underneath, one wing black and the other one white. So instant recognition. Well, fair enough. It went on smashing. We knew it as soon as we saw them coming down. Right, these are Italians. Let's blast them with the old. We had some Lewis guns. We had some Lewis guns, the old fashioned ones, mainly with the Brens, on fixed tripods, you know. And we fought them, and there was a light incident. We had the adjutant who was telling us, Fox Davis, the one who came to Aegis with. He was then promoted company commander, Major Fox Davis, after that, and we lost him as adjutant. We got another chap, I can't remember his name. And the commanding officer, Scouty Ardern, Houdini as we call him, he's one hell of a man. I've often heard it said that everybody's got fear, but I've never seen fear in this bloke, not at any time. And he served as company commander for a few years in the desert, and then when we went to Malta, I've never seen fear on his face at all. And he used to come up the front line, and to tell you this, the sort of bloke he was, he went up to inspect the defences of Merseyside Metro when we first went up there, and this adjutant was next to him, and he sat him on the shoulder. Excuse me, he said, just wait a minute, I'm talking to the company commander here. Let's say, wait a minute, I'm still talking to the company. Excuse me, he said, I'm talking to the company commander. He said, sorry, I've got to interrupt myself. You're standing on a bloody mine. And he looked down, he said, good God, so I am. Stood off it. He went back to one of the first posts he got, there was telephone communication, went up to the engineers and said, I've just stood on a mine, I haven't been blown up, why not? This was the sort of bloke he was. And he said, well, send somebody up to fix it. Of course, they sent two blokes up, and he was elsewhere at the time. As soon as they knelt down to touch the mine up, it went. The poor blokes lost their lives. But this is the sort of man he was. He, as I said, I don't think he had an ounce of fear. And we used to call him a maniac, you know. This is one of the reasons why he got the name Houdini. He'd get out of anything. He was that sort of fella. He didn't show for, if he had, he certainly didn't show to us. And there was another chap he came up to inspect the, again, one, you know, you're constantly altering your defences, dependent on what you expect to meet, reciting in various positions, digging more positions if you need them further up, to sort of gradually withdraw on. The defences were built on a box, sort of box-like defences, so that you move from one box to the other, and you had to go through these communication trenches in order to get to them. Very much the same as what in the 1418 war. And he came up to have a look at them, see that everything was all right, and the air raid came. All these fighters, we came over in Strafford, and for telling you about the black and white wings of ours, and the adjutant was looking up, and he was a great whiskey man, and he had his flask out, and he was stuck his whiskey with his binoculars, and he was drinking his whiskey at the same time out of his flask, and the colonel said, are they black and white? He says, no, sir, it's John Haig. You know, these are the sort of things that it's laughable at the time, but at the time it was so serious, and everybody just sort of smiled until afterwards, and they realised what it was, and he was standing there amongst these fighters going all hell for leather, and they were trying to knock hell out of us, and he said, oh no, sir. But this, you got these incidents which you thought afterwards, you didn't think so at the time, but it was a life which was boring, because there was nothing happening other than the work of rebuilding trenches, digging new ones, defences wherever you were sent to. We were constantly going back to the regiment late post, which was much further back in BHQ. Not the advanced HQ, and which was B echelon, which was further back for supplies, because you were having to deal with sick as well. As a stretchy bearer, you just didn't wait until somebody got hit with a bullet or with a piece of shrapnel. You had sickness as well to contend with.
Did you have much sickness?
Not really. The biggest thing that we had with regard to six is what we call desert sores. And there wasn't anything, it was just like a pinprick would appear on your hand. And it was always on the hands, I don't know why, it was always on the hands. And it would just develop into a huge, matry sore, sometimes going as much as an inch and a half across. And we didn't know what to treat it with. We were called back to the base headquarters who B echelon to have a talk with the medical officer, and he had taken up with the GHQ in Cairo with the general hospital through there, the chap there who he knew was at the hospital, because we changed our medical officer then. We've got Jock Lees, he was supposed to have been a specialist in Harley Street. He was a hell of a doctor, he's a nice fellow now, and he had talked with one of his friends through there, and he said, well, the only thing that we come across was Vaseline and sulfonamide, a powder, and he said, this is how you treat it. And all we could do was put a circle of Vaseline on the, you sort of built it up, as it were, out of a tube or a tin, and he put the sulfinamide powder on the top and then put some gauze over the top of that and just bandaged it loosely. And it did clear it up. We had that paid out, I suppose, for months that was going on without any treatment that we knew of. Aquaflavin bandages that we used to put on, or different ointments that we had, and just didn't do a thing. But the sulfonamide powder cured it with the Vaseline. So after that was just a question of sore throats. When I even had a touch of measles. A very healthy regimen, a very healthy battalion we had. Very little boils, which were obvious. You know, you treat your treatment of boils and that, which was normal. One chap was so severe that they had to send him back to the echelon to get a treat at the regiment late post. But they sent him back after a day and said, well, you just carry on with the treatment. What's it? A Kaelin poultice. That was it. We used to use Kaelin poultice. Hell of a bloody hell. That Kaelin. We used it for everything, bucket, whatever it was. Oh, yeah.
Did you become involved in treating any of the wounded, either through bombing or accidents?
Yes, we had very few. At that particular stage, so we were very few. The high-level bombing was such that it was they were way out in the desert. I think they just wanted to drop the bombs anywhere and get back home, sort of thing. You know, you never had any accuracy like you had with our own air force or the Germans. But very few was with bullet holes. As I say, these fighters used to come over, but by then the RAF had got them more or less mastered, and they were then beginning to attack the. Because by that time we had got a few Hurricanes up that had been shipped out, and the Hurricanes made a short work of them, so we had very little of those after a while, and even less of the Savoy bombers. So we had a fairly peaceful time right up, and I think it was about November.
Did the bombing raids have any effect on morale at all?
One or two we got to what we call bomb happy, because it's something that they'd never experienced before. And I think a lot of the lads were really nervous about it. They wouldn't tell you that they were frightened, because they didn't want to fear to be sissies or cowards or anything. But one or two of the lads we had to send back, because they were just like walking zombies. And it wasn't a lot of bombing that we had, but it really affected some of them so badly that we had to send them back to B Echelon. And they were eventually, I don't know where they went, we never got them back again. They were just merely pushed back to the base depot somewhere around Cairo or Ismailia, somewhere down that way. We didn't. You either had it, Harry, or you didn't have stomach to stay up there. And it wasn't, let's face it, it's not their fault. It's not a case of cowardice at all. A lot of people think it is. It's not. It's just the lad just gets into a bundle of nerves and he can't do anything about it.
You mentioned regimental aid post. What constituted a regimental aid post?
Whatever was there at the time, as I said, in Matru, we had this Anderson purpose built one. Now, the rest of the companies weren't so fortunate. They had a larger dugout that probably just was covered over with some wood and some corrugated iron on the top. And they were wide open on either side. Ours was a beautiful affair. Whatever happened to be there, if you were on the move in the desert, you come across this hut, and that was going to be the regimental aid post, or whatever you decided. Sometimes you didn't have one at all.
And who was in charge of it?
Well, the senior stretcher bearer at the time. You had four stretcher bearers to a company, which was relegated to three, you know, depending on how the availability of them were, because you had leave to contend with and sickness to contend with, you know. So we had four in each company, and the senior man was in charge of that. And you were responsible as I say, the echelon, the main hospital unit, which was manned by, I think it was about three or four stretcher bearers, Sergeant McNally, who was the top dog, and of course Chuck Lees, the medical officer. They were the force that we had. They used to come out frequently and, you know, have a look at us and see how we're doing, asking any problems.
What kind of treatment could you give in that situation, right at the front, in effect, the three or four of you?
For on wounds,
if there's anyone was wounded or whatever.
Well, we had a sack of, or have a sack full of various sized shell dressings, which covered anything from a bullet wound to a fairly large shrapnel wound. We were allowed to put tourniquets on, but we had to, if we put a tourniquet on, we had to ensure that the man was transported immediately back to B Echelon, the nearest transport that would take it, as quickly as possible, and at the same time write a note on it, because we were given little targets at the time that you put the tourniquet on and the time it was due to come off, what time you put it on, what date you put it on. so that when he was going back, because actually I don't suppose along this military road, it wouldn't take them about 15, 20 minutes to get down there. But it had to be slackened off. And there we used to send a bloke, if it was a serious one, we used to send a bloke back with him in a truck. There was no such thing as ambulances because we didn't have them. You had to send them back in a 1,500-weight truck or a 3-ton truck or even a carrier, a Bren gun carrier, whatever transport was available at the time. We weren't as well equipped as what they are nowadays, where the medics nowadays are really first-class people. They're really trained right up in the locker.
And for going out to collect someone who couldn't get in, you know, someone who was wounded some distance away from you, did that come into your experience at this particular time?
At this particular time, not a lot of it, Harry. The only time it ever came in was during Wavell's push, when the 7th Armoured Brigade went up the desert. Now, we followed them on. We weren't actually taking part in the actual physical fighting until a later stage. But we did used to do this sort of thing. Again, it was just one of those things. If you were near an advanced field hospital, fair enough, you were all right. You could get in touch with them by field telephone. I mean, in those days, the wireless between forward companies and places like that were just non-existent. Nearly all field telephones. And whenever you set up, you stop for the night, you immediately run out to the signal company. Or the signal platoon used to run out telephone lines to the various companies, or platoon headquarters, whichever you were with. But we had no such things as radios. Radio truck.